The following episode of Lyrics of Their Life podcast deals with serious issues such as drug references, sexual references, and violence that may be distressing to some listeners. It is not suitable for children. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome to Lyrics of Their Life, the podcast that talks about the extraordinary lives lived by those that wrote or performed the songs we know and love. I'm your host Adam Hampton, and in today's episode, we take an in-depth look into the story of Meatloaf, the larger-than-life character that wooed audiences all around the world with his captivating stage presence and high-energy live performances, combined with his roaring and sometimes soothing tenor vocals. Forming a dynamic duo with the musical genius of songwriter Jim Steinman, Meatloaf would deliver rock opera-style mega-hits like Bat Out of Hell, You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth, Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Read 'Em and Weep, and of course, his comeback song, I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That, just to name a few. In this epic story, we follow Meatloaf's journey from his troubled childhood, faced with extreme bullying surrounding his weight and the harsh treatment by his father that at times turned physical, the impact the death of his mother had on him, and how exactly he got his big break in the music industry, as we follow the highs and lows of Meatloaf's career, littered with drug abuse, relationship woes, health concerns, and the fear of losing the one thing that set him apart from the rest, his voice, as we wrap up the story with his final days on earth before heaven could no longer wait, taking the legendary performer from us at the age of 74. So, without further ado, this is the story of Meatloaf. This is Lyrics of Their Life.
Prince has died at the age of 57.
This is it.
Sorry, Gary, but I was always the talented member of the band.
Keep booing, little girl. I will hit a man with glasses.
I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Former Beatle John Lennon, who was 40, was shot and killed last night outside his luxury apartment in New York.
Asbeens shouldn't present fucking awards to Gunna Be.
Leave Britney alone!
Meatloaf was born Marvin Lee Day on the 27th of September 1947 in Baylor Hospital in Dallas, Texas, in the United States of America. Marvin would be raised as an only child to his parents Wilma Artie Huckel and Orvis Wesley Day, who met in Tennessee before settling in Dallas, with Marvin claiming that when he was born, he was, quote, bright red and stayed that way for days. Marvin was also said to have been quite a large baby and claimed that his father thought he looked like, quote, my son looks like 4.5 pounds of ground chuck beef, with his father Orvis even going as far as convincing the hospital staff to write the name Meat on his crib name card where the baby's name usually reads. Due to his skin remaining so red, Marvin would be required to stay in hospital for a couple more days until he was fit to go. From here on out, or from the age of 9 months old, as Marvin remembers, Marvin would be referred to by his father as Meat, and this would eventually catch on around town, with everyone around town referring to Marvin as Meat. Marvin's mother, Wilma, was born back in 1913 and was 34 years old when she gave birth to him. Wilma was raised by her parents David Lee Huckel and Charles Lee Norod, and was raised in the Hamilton and Dallas, Texas areas. As an adult, Wilma worked as a school teacher, teaching the subject of English at Dallas Public School, as Marvin, or Meatloaf, revealed in his autobiography to Helen Back, quote, "She was an incredibly smart woman," with Marvin claiming that she went on to work at this school for 25 years. Wilma was also a gospel singer, who with her sister Texie performed with two other women to form a quartet known as the Vodiodo Girls, with Meat claiming, quote, "My mother had a powerful singing voice, something like Kate Smith's," as Marvin would go along and watch his mother perform, likely being his first and most influential influence on his own musical career. Wilma's other two sisters, Mary and Cecil, weren't interested in becoming singers, but Marvin's mother and his auntie wanted to take their musical careers further and managed to perform on Bill Cosby's radio show. But due to their parents' strict Christian beliefs, this wasn't encouraged at all, and subsequently, their quartet would split up and go their separate ways. Marvin's father, Orvis, was born and raised by his parents, Marvin Wesley Aday and Eula Jane Myers, in Hunt, Texas, in 1915, and was 2 years younger than Wilma, with Marvin, of course, carrying on his grandfather's name. When Marvin was born, Orvis was around 32 years of age. According to Marvin, his father Orvis loved racing dirt bikes and hunting, where he even once had a .22 shell in his leg from a hunting accident, and even accidentally shot his finger off one time. Marvin's father Orvis worked as a Dallas-based police officer, but would give this up to work independently, starting his own business as a salesman, selling his own formula of cough syrup, called KO syrup, made from corn syrup. Orvis collaborated with one of his closest friends, and Wilma, his wife, who worked on the books for his business, calling it Griffin Grocery Company, travelling to small towns to promote and sell it, however large chemists wouldn't take it on. Sadly, however, Orvis's drinking problem was his downfall after business started to boom, and he ended up giving the business to someone else, who ended up making a fortune off of it. Sadly for Marvin, his father Orvis wasn't the nicest man to be around after he returned home from World War II, where he turned to alcohol to drown his sorrows. Once he was drunk, this would result in Orvis becoming quite abusive and belittling, especially to Marvin, which Marvin puts down to a jealousy that Orvis had for him once he arrived home, labelling his father as, quote, immature due to the love that Wilma held for her son. Orvis was said to have binged on alcohol for days to deal with the undiagnosed PTSD and trauma caused by his experiences in World War II as a supply sergeant, as Marvin claims that his father was travelling in a boxcar on a train when he was wounded by fragments from a mortar shell embedding into his leg very early on into the campaign, when the Americans were first deployed into Germany, which ultimately saw him be medically discharged from the US Army and sent home much earlier than he would have liked to, with Orvis never speaking about his time there. Marvin remembers from as early as age 4, spending many nights out with his mother, driving in the car, searching the streets for his drunken father, occasionally finding him at pubs around Dallas, but often returning home without him, as Orvis would usually be getting blind drunk in bars in the Fort Worth and Dallas area. In the past, Marvin's mother Wilma would often attempt to enter the bar and retrieve Orvis, but But as young Marvin turned 8 years old, he would attempt to take care of his mother and be the man of the house, as he would insist on going in for her and retrieving his father, as Marvin was quite a large boy, and women like his mother walking into a bar that time of night would have been potentially unsafe, despite just being a kid himself. His mother often protested, but Marvin insisted and would do it for his mother. Scared out of his mind, but determined not to show his mother this, Marvin would put on a brave face and enter the bar, describing them as hellholes and, quote, "that must have been the sleaziest, funkiest stretch of ground in the entire country. The most gut-bucket, redneck, low-life bars you could possibly imagine." When Marvin would emerge with his father, sadly Orvis would tell him he'd be home soon, but time and time again he would be let down, as he went on benders for as long as 4 days. Due to his father's abusive behaviour, which he seemed to take out on Marvin, which once resulted in Marvin being thrown through plate glass windows and front doors, he would often be taken to his grandmother, Charles C. Hookles, to stay the night to get away from him. With the sad reality being that Marvin's main positive childhood memories were the times spent away from his father at his grandmother's house. However, due to spending so much time here, he was present at the time of his grandfather's death in his grandparents' house. As he says, it stuck with him for the rest of his life, as his illness had a specific smell. Marvin was also raised in a strict Christian household and would attend church every Wednesday and Sunday with his mother, as well as attending Bible study and vacation care Bible school. So reading the Bible was a common practice for Marvin, something he would later utilize in the themes of his music. Meat's mother especially was committed to her faith in God and attempted to have this rub off on young Marvin, as his grandfather was also a minister in the church. Meatloaf, or Marvin's favourite song as a child, was 16 Tons by Tennessee Ernie Ford, as he often mimed along to the lyrics and played the bongo drums to the rhythm of the song. And then he got into the music of Johnny Preston. What's most surprising, however, was that Marvin was actually not that into listening to music as a kid until he reached high school, when he got into the likes of the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, the Kingston Trio, and his mother's favourite, Mahalia Jackson. As young Marvin claims that the first album he ever bought was 12 by 5 by the Rolling Stones, and that his favourite song from them was Let It Bleed from their 5th studio album. Marvin did, however, love to sing, as he would occasionally get lost singing along to the radio in the car. As Marvin remembers one particular Christmas, they were travelling as a family to his auntie Texie's house in Amarillo, Texas, when Marvin began to sing, only for his mother to pull up at a red stoplight and say, quote, "It's a good thing you're never going to be a singer, 'cause you can't carry a tune in a bucket," which Marvin believes was probably the harshest thing that his mother ever said to him, as he described her as an angel who he got his kindness from. When he was young, Marvin would wear glasses and was quite a solid and big boy for his age, and sadly, as the years progressed, he continually put on more and more weight, causing him to develop social anxiety and clumsiness, as he often fell off of things or ran into things, causing concussions. Marvin believes being overweight stemmed from his father and his father's brother's influence, as his brother Irvin was a hugely obese man, as they often sat around drinking beers together. By the time Marvin attended school, he was quite a large and overweight boy, with his mother deciding to start him in grade 1 as opposed to kindergarten, as he was much larger than the other kids. Marvin even claimed that he was so big that in school group photos, he looked like the teacher. His size made him an easy target for quite severe bullying, and when these bullies got wind of his father's nickname for him, of course being Meat, they decided to call Marvin Meatloaf. As Meatloaf talked about his weight in pounds by telling VH1's Behind the Music, "I was 185 pounds when I was like 10 years old, and when I was 12, I weighed 245. And before that, I was really big." Meatloaf's future ex-wife, Leslie Adai, would also tell Behind the Music, quote, "He was tortured by the schoolyard kids, who always locked him in a box. In the schoolyard where you put all the basketballs in at the end of the day, and you put a padlock on, and he was just 7 years old, and they all captured him and put him in this box and locked him in it. And he never came home, and his mother had to call the police, and it was just because of his size." During that traumatic experience, Meatloaf sat frightened in the box for hours as the bell rang for home time. Panic would have set in as he began to scream out, but no one came to help him. Eventually, the police came and let Meatloaf out. Meatloaf would often end up in schoolyard fights with more than one kid at a time as they attempted to take him down, outnumbering him because of his size. As he claims, he practically fought every kid in his class at one point and faced as many as 12 kids at once, as it got that bad. While Meat was often left out of games and fun with other kids, as he was, quote, too fat, which he believes led to him being a loner for much of his life, often having to find other ways to entertain himself. Meat would become quite a rebellious child and claims that he often ran away from home and would run down to the local 7-Eleven and hang out with the man on the checkout, who would give Meat free food and drink such as Dr. Peppers and a hot link sausage, no doubt contributing to his weight gain. With Meat running away constantly, his mother was driven to the point of tying him to the clothesline pole with rope just to stop him from doing it. However, he quickly learnt how to untie himself, so his parents made a more extreme decision to move across town to Kendall Drive, away from that 7-Eleven. However, he found a new way to spend his time and torment his parents by exploring creek beds down in the bush and getting stuck in quicksand, to even staging that his own house got robbed just so he could see what was inside of one of his Christmas presents. As a teenager, Meatloaf would attend Thomas Jefferson High School in Dallas, Texas, where he even appeared in plays and musicals such as The Music Man and Where's Charlie? Meat would also perform in the school choir and was part of the school debate team, saying, quote, "You don't want to argue with me." During high school, Meat had a few girlfriends and, despite his size, was quite popular with the ladies. Despite being a large boy, Meatloaf was quite athletic and mobile and loved sport. So while here at Thomas Jefferson, Meatloaf would play gridiron or American football and became a standout defensive tackle, with ambitions of one day going pro. During one particular game at the junior high school Cotton Bowl, while his mother was in attendance cheering him on, his father, Orvis, who was often a no-show, made his first appearance to one of his games. But as predicted, he was rotten drunk after sitting in the bar all day, and would begin calling out things and yelling abuse towards Meatloaf's coach, asking why wasn't Meat on the field, despite Meat being a defensive player as the offensive team was on the field. This embarrassed Meatloaf tremendously, and in his words, it was, quote, mortifying. After being called Meat or ML, which stood for Michael Lee, for many years, when Meat was 13 years old in the 8th grade, his nickname would evolve even further, when Meat claimed that he accidentally stepped on his football coach's foot, and to which his coach replied, "Get off my foot, you big hunk of meatloaf," as the kids on the team that overheard it began to laugh. The very next day, Meat went into his locker and noticed some kids had written the word meatloaf as two separate words on his locker. This, of course, would stick from here on out as his brand new nickname. Meat also claims that he would get called Mighty Large and Tree Trunks by his football coaches because of the size of his legs. Meatloaf over the years had many stories of how he got his name, Meatloaf, and often he would play around with interviewers when they asked him about the origin of his name. For example, on an Irish talk show in 1984, Meatloaf claimed that he got his name from the time he hung out in the pub too long one evening and won a crazy bet that he could have a Volkswagen car tyre roll over his head for $100. As he claims, quote, "After that, they began to tell me I had meatloaf for brains." Meatloaf would often bend the truth using real stories and adding to them, with this being a real bet that he made. However, the meatloaf reference wasn't part of it. Another sport that Meatloaf excelled in was shot put, utilizing his power and strength to throw the heavy shot put up to 50 feet or more away, claiming his personal best was 54 feet, and that he once came fourth place in a shot put meet, or carnival, held in Dallas, Texas. Adding to his long list of concussions, one time Meat would be struck in the head by a shot put from 60 feet away, leaving a dent in his head that he carried throughout life, which he would later joke to interviewers, claiming it gave him his great singing voice. As Meatloaf revealed in an interview, quote, "I was standing 62 feet away, with my back turned, warming up, and there was no way anyone thought it would be tossed that far. But the guy who hit me was the champion of Dallas. Everyone else was throwing them about 30 feet. At the age of 13, Meatloaf even started his very first rock and roll band, and described himself around this time as a chubby kid even in high school, with glasses and a bowl cut. But, despite his nerdy appearance, he was very rebellious and described himself as a, quote, "mean footballer." Despite being a large boy, Meat still had success with the ladies, and at the age of 11 in grade 5, he shared a three-way kiss with some girls, as he said, quote, "I had my first three-way in my mother's car in the fifth grade. Okay, it was a make-out session with two girls, but that's still a threesome." Despite his claims of being popular with the ladies, Meat also admitted to being very quiet and shy, which in some ways contradicts his own stories. Known in his adult life as someone that loves to talk non-stop, in the documentary In Search of Paradise, Meatloaf said, quote, "When I was younger, I was very quiet, very shy, didn't talk. In 3 years of being at Thomas Jefferson High School, if I spoke more than 12 words, I'd actually be shocked and surprised." Before the age of 16, Meatloaf would apply for and be accepted for a hardship driver's license, which in the state of Texas allowed young people under the age of 16 to get their driver's license before the legal age, waiving the age requirement due to certain hardships that may be financial or medical. In Meat's case, his parents were unable to drive him around and get him to school, so Meat would learn the responsibility of driving himself strictly back and forth from school. Despite this, Meatloaf wouldn't exactly follow the rules and would often drive around Dallas with his friends in his first car, which was a 1958 Buick Special. Meatloaf would take a few girls on dates in this car and, oddly enough, revealed to Huckabee on TBN that after these dates, he would occasionally head down to Parkland Hospital and sit in the car to watch all the gunshot victims be brought in to the emergency section of the hospital. As in his opinion, it was something to do, as there wasn't much to do around Dallas. At the age of 16, on one particular day, the 22nd of November, 1963 to be exact, while driving around with his best mates Jimmy McWhorter and Billy Slocum, who was Meat's closest childhood friend, who he referred to as a good-looking guy who got all the girls. He was captain of the football team, confident, rode motorbikes, bulls, and dated the prom queen. But, to get back on track, earlier that day, the three friends had heard that the 35th President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, was set to be arriving in Dallas, Texas that day. So, in hopes of meeting him, Meat, Jimmy and Billy, like many school kids that day, got permission slips from their parents to skip school and drove around looking for him as they arrived at Dallas Love Field, where he was set to arrive. When they got to the field, however, they noticed it was ridiculously packed, with people everywhere. Frustrated that they wouldn't be able to get a closer look at JFK, Jimmy revealed that he was tipped off by his own father, who worked at the airport, that JFK was set to come through his gate that day. So, off the three friends went, and sure enough, they saw JFK. Meat was too shy to introduce himself, however, but Billy, who was more confident, was able to shake the president's hand. After that, they were set to follow him to Market Hall to watch his speech, but with time to spare, they decided to go bowling at Mickey Mantle's bowling alley. Only when they arrived, they were told by a female employee at the desk that JFK had just been shot. In shock and in disbelief, they didn't initially believe the woman until they heard it over the radio. The three boys then bolted out of the bowling alley and into the parking lot, yelling out, quote, "The president's been shot," as onlookers yelled back, quote, "You kids stop that."
Here is a news bulletin from the CBC television news service. Here is a picture of President Kennedy and his wife taken just before he was shot today in Dallas, Texas. President Kennedy is reported to be fighting for his life in a Dallas hospital, but reports conflict. CBS says he is dead. Here is a picture of the president. You've seen the picture of the president just before he was shot in the limousine in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Kennedy was struck in the head. The governor of Texas, John Connally, was shot in the back. It's reported the American Vice President, Lyndon Johnson, was also shot, but he is not in serious condition in an emergency operation. That was a bulletin from the CBC television news service.
Wondering what their next step was to investigate what just went down, the three boys made an informed decision to stop by at Parkland Hospital, knowing that's where they'd take someone with gunshot wounds. On the way, however, while driving on the Stemmons Freeway, they met another roadblock when Meat's car was pulled over by a Secret Serviceman who was standing in the middle of the road, forcing them to pull over. When they stopped, the man slammed his badge on the window and told Meat to move over and that he needed his car, as Meat told Huckabee, quote, "So I scoot over and I'm petrified." So, with the three boys still in the car, the Secret Serviceman sped to Parkland Hospital, and when they arrived, Meat noticed that there was, quote, "sharpshooters all ready and waiting on the ground and the roof of buildings, and on the hospital, in case there was a second attack on the president." As the Secret Serviceman told the boys to remain in the car as he entered the hospital. Meat claims he didn't know what to do and was simply in shock, as they all sat frozen, asking what had just happened. While sitting in the car, still in shock, they saw that JFK had already been rushed into the hospital, but noticed that JFK's wife and First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis had only just hopped out of the limousine, covered in blood, as she was escorted into the hospital. Eventually, the three boys decided to get out and go and have a look at the limousine. And on closer inspection, Meat remembers seeing flowers being placed by the limousine, while blood was still present all over the vehicle, which shocked him tremendously. However, he said that the image of the limousine with the flowers and the blood was, quote, beautiful, but morbid at the same time.
I have just talked to Father Oscar Hubert of the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. He and another priest tell me that the pair of men have just administered the last rites of the Catholic Church to President Kennedy. President Kennedy has been assassinated. It's official now. The president is dead. Women here in shock, some fainted. Grown men, Secret Service men standing by the emergency room, tears streaming down their face. There's only one word to describe the picture here, and that's grief, and much of it. It's official. As of just a few moments ago, the President of the United States is dead.
The Secret Service men then returned out of the hospital and offered the boys $100 each for their trouble. However, they refused to take the money due to understanding the circumstances as to why he needed the car, and instead asked for just $5. After the man left, Meat got the $5 and tore it into three pieces and gave it to each of his friends, and kept one for himself, with Billy and Meat both framing theirs and keeping it to this day as a memento to that crazy and historic day. While an interview that the three boys did for a TV news coverage that day still exists out there somewhere, which they used to prove it to their football coach as to why they were late for football training that day, and to Meat's mother, who didn't believe his story. Sadly, however, this event would stick with Meatloaf for his lifetime, and he never quite got over it. Like this crazy story, Meatloaf would have so many more where that came from, even claiming that he once picked up a hitchhiker in the 60s that offered him to come to a party with Beach Boys member Dennis Wilson, with the driver, of course, turning out to be Charles Manson. To complete his schooling, a 17-year-old Meatloaf would attend the private Lubbock Christian College in Lubbock, Texas, during 1965, where he claims he was made to complete Bible tests, where he scored 99 on his Old Testament Bible exam and 97 on his New Testament Bible exam, while he also studied constitutional law, history, drama, speech therapy, improv, and music appreciation, which he claims he got thrown out of. After leaving school, now aged 18 years old, Meatloaf would then receive a transfer to the University of North Texas in Dallas-Fort Worth during 1966, where Meat continued to excel in theatre, acting, and drama, as well as at American football, with his size greatly helping him in the position of defensive tackle. Like the typical American footballers, Meat would bang his head on the lockers before matches to get fired up. He wasn't a naturally gifted athlete, but he was a hard worker and became a solid player because of his work ethic. Meat claims that while playing gridiron, that he got concussed at least 7 times, but he loved it so much because, quote, "Because I got to hit people, I took my anger out. That's what I took onto the stage in the late 70s. In fact, I still take it onto the stage. I was always a performer." On the 4th of August of 1967, when Meatloaf was just 19, he would sadly lose his 54-year-old mother Wilma to breast cancer after she battled the disease for much of Meat's childhood. Meat would later go on to claim that it took him at least 10 years to grieve and recover from his mother's death, as this was sadly due to the fact that the last time he tried to talk to his mother, they had a silly, pointless argument when he was returning to North Texas University after being home for the holidays. Wilma's passing meant that Meat was left home alone with his drunken father Orvis, who had quit alcohol with the help of Wilma, only to get right back into the booze once she had passed away, just to cope. Meatloaf was very distraught by his mother's death, as he was quite close to her, and just a day after he laid his mother to rest at her funeral, where he claimed that he was so emotional during the open casket that he grabbed his mother's body and screamed, "You can't have her," at the undertakers. Just 4 days after his mother's funeral, Meatloaf was sitting at home hanging out with his friend Billy Slocum in the living room when they overheard Meatloaf's father Orvis arrive home in a fit of rage. Before he could even walk through the door, Meat told Billy that he better go, and Billy agreed. Billy hopped up and quickly left out the back door, as Billy and Meat's friends all knew what his father was like. Sure enough, Orvis had been drinking heavily that day and walked in reeking of booze, with Meat claiming for the entire 4 days after the funeral, no one had even seen him or heard from him, with Meat left to grieve and take care of himself. In a drunken and disillusioned state of mind, due to the mix of grief and alcohol, Orvis walked into the living room and then accused Meat of having girls over, despite there clearly being none at all, as Meat recalls his father saying, "Get these women out of here," and Orvis began to chastise him for no good reason, as Meatloaf then yelled back at his father and said, quote, "I'm not talking to you, just leave me alone." Meatloaf would then run off to his bedroom and slam the door shut, before turning on the TV that his grandmother had left for him, only then to hear his father's footsteps come running down the hallway before kicking the door in and coming at Meatloaf with a butcher's knife in an instant, flashing the knife in Meatloaf's face. As Meatloaf told behind the music, quote, "He didn't say anything. He's come straight at me." Realizing his father wasn't playing around, Meat quickly rolled out of the way and off of the bed, as his father brought the butcher's knife down, connecting with Meat's bed, with force. Once the realization had set in what his father had just done, and that he was willing to kill his son, Meatloaf's fight or flight response kicked in, and no longer would he take his father's abuse, realizing that with his size, he could easily take down his own father. As Meatloaf said, quote, "At that point, I don't remember getting out of the bedroom, but I remember taking him out of the bedroom. I remember really going at him, because you're fighting for your life at that point. It was either me or him. I fought my way out of that house." Meat claimed on the Dan Rava show, quote, "I was later told I broke his nose, 3 ribs, and left him laying there." Meatloaf escaped the house barefoot, wearing just the clothes on his back, including gym shorts and a t-shirt, as he wouldn't look back and literally left his life in Dallas behind, hopping on a flight to Los Angeles during 1967. For a while, Meatloaf struggled to find his place in LA, struggling to fit in, as all Meat brought with him was a suitcase of belongings, the clothes on his back, and his guitar, as he hoped to land an opportunity far away from his troubles, as he said, quote, "Carrying a guitar, suitcase, wearing cowboy boots, jeans, sports coat, and I probably weighed about 300 pounds, and I guarantee you, I looked like I was from another planet." Meatloaf claimed on the Jonathan Ross show that he was homeless for about 9 months when he first came to LA, living up in the hills above the Magic Castle, known for being the Academy of Magical Arts, located off Franklin Avenue in Hollywood Heights in LA, California. With Meat claiming, he started off with a sleeping bag before slowly making enough money to buy himself a tent as he even claims he had to fend off wild coyotes who roamed the area up in the hills as they approached his campsite often. By 1968, after meeting some fellow musicians at a youth centre, Meatloaf would form a band that went by the name Meatloaf Soul, as they gigged around the LA, California scene, with their first gig being at the Cave at Huntington Beach in California, where they were the support act for Van Morrison's band called Them, and for Question Mark and the Mysterians. While in Meatloaf Soul, as well as being the lead singer, Meat would run the sound and adjust the lighting, set up the gear and instruments, and wouldn't allow his bandmates to help him, as he claimed that they only slowed him down, as Meat would double as the band's singer and their very own roadie. With Meatloaf Soul going through countless lead guitarists, including Frank Montoya, the band became quite unsettled and struggled to gel. So to find their way, they would try name changes to Floating Circus and Popcorn Blizzard. As Popcorn Blizzard, they would achieve the most success and would release a double-side 7-inch EP under Magenta Records in 1968, with the songs called Once Upon a Time and Hello in the style of psychedelic hippie pop rock music common for the late 60s, with plenty of organ and guitar solos. At the time, the members of the band consisted of Meatloaf, under his birth name Marvin Lee Adday, on vocals, Christopher Carell on lead guitar, Michael Jean on backing vocals and rhythm guitar, Rick Bazoon on bass, Susie Kane on vocals and keyboard, and Peter Woodman on drums and percussion. Under their various band names, Popcorn Blizzard would go on to support huge acts like Jimi Hendrix, Grateful Dead, MC5, The Stooges, The Fugs, The Kinks, The Who, and even Janis Joplin with Big Brother and The Holding Company. While they even went on a large-scale tour of the US alongside Ted Nugent. Being on the road led the band to settle in Detroit, Michigan, where Meat said, quote, "That band eventually wound up in Michigan. We lived in a house in Freeland, Michigan, for a year and played in the Grand Ballroom 80 times and opened for everybody you could imagine." As a band, they had other recording contract offers but never followed through with them, as Meat was growing bored of the project and the type of music they were playing, as acting, to Meatloaf, was more appealing. Struggling to find his way in LA and his purpose, Meatloaf began struggling with depression and suicidal thoughts, and during 1968, he claims he almost took his own life and was about to jump off a bridge when he saw the spirit of his deceased mother, Wilma. When speaking with Dan Rava, Meat claims his mother Wilma told him not to go through with it, as he was quoted as saying, "I tried to jump off a bridge in 68, and it was my mother who stopped me, and she got me off the bridge, and I turned around, and it was a long walkway to get to the end of this bridge, and then that person was gone." Meat continued on by claiming his mother spoke to him on the bridge, saying, quote, "You have a lot to live for," and by also explaining that she didn't hold it against him when they had their argument right before she passed, as Meat had carried a lot of guilt around since her passing over this particular argument. This spiritual awakening, in a sense, would almost spark a new beginning for Meatloaf, which would take him onto bigger and better things. Towards the end of 1968, Meatloaf made the decision to disband Popcorn Blizzard, aka Meatloaf Soul, and resign to the fact that he might never achieve his dream, and that he should start looking for a permanent residence and an average day job. After living on the road and being homeless, Meatloaf settled in Detroit, moving into a share house with a man named Barney, who happened to work as a parking attendant at the Aquarius Theatre parking lots. During 1968, the musical Hair was about to debut at the Aquarius Theatre and just so happened to be holding auditions for their very first live theatre shows. During this time, Meat was informed by his housemate Barney that one of the guys he was working with had just quit as a parking attendant and a job had now opened up, telling Meat that he should apply for it as it pays between $300 to $500 a week, which was great money for the late 60s. Keen to start earning his keep, Meat arrived at 10 a.m. for his job interview, and while he waited, he was introduced by Barney to a man named Greg Carlos, who had just parked up his car and was involved in the production of Hair. As Meatloaf told Huckabee, quote, "He looks at me and walks straight up to me and goes, 'You sing?' I went, 'Yeah.' And he goes, 'Well, why aren't you auditioning?' As Meat's interviewer hadn't yet turned up, Meat decided to sneak off and audition for Hair. Meat recalls that when he arrived, he noticed the line for the auditions was so long that it stretched down the block, and at 290 pounds, he was worried that his size would be a major factor in being picked or not picked for a role. Meat was also quite discouraged by the long line, and producer Greg Carlos must have saw something in him, however, as he found a way for him to cut the queue, as Meat told Huckabee, quote, "I said I wouldn't stand in line for food, so he goes, 'Okay, you don't have to stand in line. Come with me and I'll get you in.'" Meatloaf then entered the large auditorium, where he was made to sit down, and he noticed the director was a, quote, "laid-back hippie guy that was lying on a mattress, watching audition after audition." When it came to Meat's turn, he didn't have a song ready, and famously told the piano player, "I just came for a job in the parking lot." So, in order to find a song, Meat dug deep into his memory bank and decided to audition with a song he learnt 2 weeks prior from a gospel singer that was called "The World Is All Right, It's the People That Make It Bad." Meat would get just 2 lines into his audition before the director would ask him to stop. As he said to Meat, quote, "What are you doing tonight?" With Meat replying, quote, "And I said, I'm hoping to get a job in the parking lot." Liking Meatloaf's style, the director then offered Meat a role in the musical Hair, and after questioning him on how much he would get paid for the gig, he happily agreed. As Meat would often joke how he came in for a parking lot job around 10 to 11 in the morning, only to walk out a member of the Hair cast by 6 p.m. For 4 months, Meat worked backstage and occasionally sang, but wouldn't yet get the opportunity to perform in an onstage character role at the Aquarius Theatre in Detroit. But after biding his time and waiting patiently for his chance, he was asked to go to Broadway to be in the main musical cast for Hair by the end of 1969, starring in replacement roles for main cast members as General Grant, Mother, and Young Recruit. Meatloaf would tour with Hair on Broadway, New York, and most notably in Detroit, at the Vest Pocket Theatre, where his portrayal of the General and Mother grabbed the attention of Motown Records. Motown Records would then invite Meatloaf to record an album's worth of Motown selected and produced songs alongside fellow Hair cast member Sean Stoney Murphy, who was a female soul vocalist from Nebraska and was only around 8 months younger than Meatloaf. When speaking about her relationship with Meatloaf, Stoney Murphy told Classic Rock Now that he was quite closed off with her, but that she admired him, and she stated, quote, "Meat always sang very dramatically, scarf in hand, and I admired his flamboyant style and amazing voice. He was a great guy, but forever into his own thing. I couldn't tell what he was thinking, even when I rented a room in his house for a year in 1972. The self-titled album, Stoney and Meatloaf, would be released over September to October 1971 around the world under Motown Records' subsidiary label, Rare Earth Records, with the album performed in the style of psychedelic soul. While the album struggled to sell, it did make it to number 25 on the Dutch chart, while the lead single, What You See Is What You Get, would make it to number 36 on the Soul chart and 71 on the US Billboard Hottest 100. Motown Records would then send Stoney and Meatloaf on tour around the USA, supporting the likes of Bob Seger, Alice Cooper, Richie Havens, The Who, and Jake Ward and the Soul Searchers. Despite things seemingly going well for Stoney and Meatloaf, a number of re-released versions of the album would see Stoney and Meatloaf's vocals be replaced on one of Meat's favourite songs on the album, titled Who Is the Leader of the People, with the singer Edwin Starr, known for his hit War, What Is It Good For, replacing the pair on the track vocally. Furious by his vocals being replaced, Meatloaf quit the Stoney and Meatloaf project and wound up auditioning for further theatre roles, landing a spot on the Broadway original cast of Rainbow at the Orpheum Theatre in New York City during 1972. Stoney, on the other hand, went on to be a backup singer for Eric Clapton and Bob Seger. As Meatloaf rose to more prominence in the theatre scene, Meat hired an agent who sourced his next role on Broadway. This led Meat to audition for his next role during early 1973 at the New York Shakespeare Festival Theatre for the play called More Than You Deserve, written by the one and only Jim Steinman. Meat would successfully land the role as the character Rabbit in the play, where Meat sung the Stoney and Meatloaf song, I'd Love to Be as Heavy as Jesus, with Meat's character Rabbit said to be a crazy maniac soldier who causes injury to his fellow soldiers by blowing them up so that they can be dismissed from the war and return home. During the audition process for More Than You Deserve, 25-year-old Meatloaf would meet 25-year-old Jim Steinman for the very first time, with Meatloaf and Jim, of course, going on to form the dynamic duo as Meatloaf, taking Meat from a theatre performer to a worldwide rock sensation. During the audition, Jim was extremely impressed with Meat, stating, quote, I was just astounded by his talent and his voice. As Jim told Rolling Stone, quote, he was larger than life. That's the first thing that registered to me. It was like a revelation. As part of the cast of More Than You Deserve, Meatloaf would receive a standing ovation for his vocals on opening night, claiming that the very moment where he received that ovation set him on his way, stating, quote, I'd never had a feeling like that ever. For Meatloaf, he claimed that this was the very first time that he realised he actually had a great voice. As Meat said, quote, the Showcase Theatre only held 100 people, but that first night, those 100 people stood on their feet and wouldn't stop applauding. Meat had finally found his calling on the theatre scene, mixing vocals with music and acting, which ultimately would form the basis for his act as Meatloaf. In 1973, while touring with the More Than You Deserve theatre production, Meatloaf would also feature in a Joe Papp production at Shakespeare in the Park at the Delacorte Open Air Theatre in New York City's Central Park, as Meat earned a role in the Shakespeare comedy called As You Like It, alongside actor Raoul Julia and actress Mary Beth Hurt. It would be during Meat's role in As You Like It that he would be approached to train to become an opera singer and was offered $60,000 compared to his current salary of $7,000 a year and promised in the future that he would be making $300,000 a year, and within 5 years, he could make his debut at the Met. However, Meek chose not to take up the offer, as he wasn't really into the operatic style of music, as he said, quote, "I couldn't do it. Opera was too confined for me." Despite this, Meek did learn something new about his voice, claiming that he was told his singing ability is characterized as a held-on tenor, which means he sings higher than it actually sounds, claiming in a 1993 interview that he was just one of three people known to possess this vocal ability at the time. In need of money to live and also support his dreams, Meatloaf was cast in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as the character Billy Bibbit, but due to a writer's strike, the production was scrapped. Instead, during 1973, Meatloaf would land arguably his biggest and most renowned role in theatre, as part of the cast for the original LA version of the Rocky Horror Show, where he was cast in two roles as Eddie, the ex-delivery boy, turned brain-dead motorcycle-riding zombie, who can sing of course, and as Dr. Everett Scott. Then, on the 11th of April 1974, Meat would hear of the passing of his father Orvis, who was 58 at the time that he passed away, in Dallas, Texas. The pair would never reconcile or meet again after that fateful day that Orvis attacked Meatloaf. However, when Meatloaf spoke to Dan Rava about his father much later on in life, about whether Meat held any guilt around his father's death, Meat replied, quote, "No, the only thing I had to do was I had to learn to forgive my father, because my father tried to kill me with a butcher's knife. And to this day, I can tell you I love my father. He had a problem. Alcohol and alcoholism is a disease, and I don't blame him. I don't remember him hitting my mother, though that could be blocked out, but he would hit me and throw me around. I take responsibility for my own actions as an adult. As far as I'm concerned, my dad has no part in my personality. When I get mad, it's not my dad's fault. It's mine." After starring in the Rocky Horror Show theatre production, Meatloaf would then be asked to star as Eddie in the big screen film adaptation of the comedy horror theatre show, known as the Rocky Horror Picture Show, starring alongside Tim Curry as Frankenfurter, who stars as the bizarre cross-dressing scientist who, along with his sidekicks, loves to rock and roll. Meat's role in the film would be featuring him singing Hot Patootie, Bless My Soul, and it was seen as a highlight of the film, which was officially released during August 1975. However, Meatloaf claims he always thought the musical was much better than the film. During 1975, as the Rocky Horror Picture Show began to air in cinemas around the world, Meatloaf would turn his focus to his career as a musician with the guidance and influence of his new friend, Jim Steinman, who he noticed was a talented songwriter and musician. Since meeting back in the audition process for More Than You Deserve 2 years prior in 1973, the pair had become incredibly close, and Meat had been attempting to persuade Jim ever since they met to form a band with him or to record a record together. Meatloaf couldn't play an instrument and wasn't a great songwriter, despite trying to write, but with his voice, he knew he had something to offer Jim. But, despite his early efforts, Meat was unsuccessful in his attempt to start a band with Jim Steinman, as Jim turned him down in favour of starting a band with a singer named Kim Milford, who Meatloaf claims had a more glamorous rock star look about him, comparing him to Rod Stewart in the looks department, and the fact that Kim could sing quite well too. However, Meat claimed that Kim didn't have the same talent or charisma that he possessed, as Meat told Behind the Music, quote, "He could sing, but he wasn't me. Eventually I convinced Jim, I just pressured the hell out of him." Jim Steinman was born James Richard Steinman on the 1st of November 1947 in Hewlett Harbour, New York, to his mother Eleanor, who was a schoolteacher teaching the subject of Latin, while his father Lewis owned his own steel supply business. James, or Jim, as his friends called him, was raised alongside his brother Bill and was known to be quite an intelligent boy, winning a history essay contest for Newsday in 1963 while attending high school, before graduating high school 2 years later in 1965 as an 18-year-old. He then went on to Amherst College in Massachusetts for a few years, majoring in drama, as he had a strong passion for the arts, theatre and acting. Jim grew up listening to Wagner, Little Richard, Beach Boys, The Beatles, The Who, The Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen, and even loved opera and classical music. While at college, Jim began writing songs and ideas for plays, and during 1968, at the age of 21, he contributed music for the Amherst version of Bertolt Brecht's A Man's a Man, before taking the next step in directing a take on Michael McClure's The Beard, and contributed further music for Bertolt Brecht's Baal by the Island Theatre Workshop on Martha's Vineyard. While during early 1969, Jim would write a book, music and lyrics for a musical called The Dream Engine that he produced as part of an assignment that year, as Jim himself, initially starring as the lead character named Baal, as the plot centres around the young boy and his rebellious group of friends called the Tribe, as they feud with the parents of the girl he is in love with, who detest their love, with these themes, of course, continuing on into the Bat Out of Hell album. The musical was so good that it attracted the attention of Joe Papp, who wanted to bring the show to New York, only for the head of the college to deny this request. Later that year in 1969, Jim graduated from Amherst College with his major in drama, and would begin working for Papp on shows, as well as providing music for a puppet show in 1971, called Ubu. During 1972, Jim worked with his old pal from Amherst College, named Barry Keating, on a musical called Rheingold, where Jim co-wrote the script and produced the music. That same year, he also collaborated with Keating again as part of the production for Bertolt Brecht's Good Woman of Szechuan. While a young and yet-to-be-famous Bette Midler would sing on an early demo track written by Jim, titled Heaven Can Wait, which of course would go on to be a Meatloaf classic. Jim's first ever song to make it onto an album of any description would be titled Happy Ending, which was sung by Yvonne Elliman, and made it onto the Food of Love album during 1973, which then brought us to the auditions for More Than You Deserve, where Jim met Meatloaf. Jim would continue to work for Joe Papp and on other productions, but nothing compared to Meatloaf. Ever since 1974, or according to some, as far back as 1972, Jim had been working on a concept album that we know well today as Bat Out of Hell. As Jim had hoped to apply the album's music to a musical theatre production called Neverland, which was intended to be a rock version of Peter Pan set in the future. When Jim quickly discovered that Kim Milford wasn't the right fit for his vision, Meat, or Meatloaf, would then come into the fold. While Jim and Meat worked on the set of the theatre production of the National Lampoon show, a plan was then laid out by the pair to get themselves signed to a recording contract and have their music released for the world to hear, with Meatloaf deciding to turn his back on theatre and focus solely on music and the Bat Out of Hell project. To get themselves up and running, they needed to have the financial backing to be a success and to have their music heard. Pitching themselves as a dynamic duo that brought a range of different skills to the table, Meat Loaf and Jim would pitch their album and themselves to multiple record labels, but to no avail, as Meat explained in his autobiography that they spent much of 1975 auditioning or pitching their album to different labels. Meat and Jim claim that the labels that knocked them back found their music to be way too Broadway, dramatic, or theatre for radio, and for the simple fact that they just wanted Meat Loaf. As their backup singer, Ellen Foley, stated, quote, "We auditioned for so many record labels or producers that were left flummoxed and confused. They were terrified by what they heard, the poor things." When Meat Loaf and Jim approached Columbia and CBS Records and were said to be closing in on a deal, they were set to be called Meat Loaf and Jim Steinman, but Jim's name was ultimately left off their band name when it came to signing the contract, and instead it was to be called Meat Loaf, with music by Jim Steinman. This was believed to be influenced by Clive Davis, who claimed that Jim couldn't write a rock song and had limited knowledge about music. This was despite Meat Loaf heavily disagreeing with him and making the brave decision to walk away from the deal. But once they had left the building, Meat would call out to Clive from the street below, saying, "Fuck you, Clive, fuck you," as he shook his fist in anger. Leaving Jim Steinman off of the band name was an unprecedented move that was done without considering Meat and Jim, and was simply not an option, especially for Meat Loaf. Meat Loaf was believed to be incredibly uncomfortable with this, as Jim claims that Meat was incredibly loyal to him, as Jim had overheard Meat on the phone to his manager, in tears over it, pleading with him that they must get Jim's name back on the band title, as he felt uncomfortable with it just being Meat Loaf. As Meat Loaf also claimed that he could have been in Ted Nugent, REO Speedwagon, or Foreigner, as CBS were happy to sign him at any cost, but they just wouldn't sign Jim. Leaving empty-handed once again, Jim and Meat would next convince well-renowned musician and producer Todd Rundgren to produce the Bat Out of Hell album for them, having lied straight to his face and telling Todd that they signed a deal with RCA Records, ultimately leaving Todd to pick up the bill for now, unbeknown to him. Meat and Jim just knew that this was their only chance to get the album made. While there were several earlier tracks recorded for the album, there were three, quote, "exceptional standouts" in Jim and Meat's eyes, including Bat Out of Hell, Heaven Can Wait, and All Revved Up, with No Place to Go, which was originally called The Formation of the Pack. Producer Todd Rundgren was initially shocked at how serious the pair were about their music, claiming to have particularly rolled around on the ground laughing at their songs in the beginning, thinking they were some sort of comedy act, with Meat being this large, sweaty, long-haired guy, and Jim being this skinny, quirky character with long hair. But once he realised they were serious and committed to the project, he thought, quote, "I've got to do this album, it's so out there." Much of 1975 involved the writing and recording process, with the production of the album taking place in late 1975 at Bearsville Studio in Woodstock, New York, followed by sessions at the House of Music in New Jersey and New York studios Utopia Sound and The Hit Factory. Joining Meat, Jim and Todd were Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band members, Roy Bittan on piano and Max Weinberg on drums, while Todd Rundgren's bandmates from Utopia also assisted during production on various instruments. Todd would play a vital role on the album's production and by playing guitar. However, his most important role was arranging the instruments, as Jim was only capable of humming the tune that he wanted, with Todd taking this and arranging it to suit his vision. While Meatloaf denies there were rifts between him and Jim during recording, the saxophone player during All Revved Up, named Edgar Winter, claims that in one instance, Meatloaf lost it at Jim when Jim stopped Meatloaf midway through a recording of For Crying Out Loud, as he wanted Meat to perform it like another singer had in the past for him, named Andre DeShields, as Winter claims that Meat said, quote, "Don't you ever mention another singer's name while I'm singing. I don't give a shit." With Meatloaf, of course, being known for having a temper, these stories were backed up by others who claimed similar clashes occurred. While Jim and Meat's vision was clear to them, not everyone in their session recordings could see the album being a hit, including Edgar Winter himself. And while most labels rejected them, not everyone thought they sucked. When Todd Rundgren finally realised that Meat and Jim weren't actually signed to RCA and that he had just spent over $200,000 during the recording process, he put them in touch with Bob Dylan's former manager, Albert Grossman, who was a fan of them after hearing their demos and almost signed them to Bearsville Records. However, he lacked the financial backing to promote the album. Warner Brothers Mo Austin then showed interest, however, he was overruled by those above him as they also didn't like Jim, due to a song he had performed many years ago live that contained explicit material. While the Warner Brothers executives weren't really impressed anyway when recently attending one of their shows. Ultimately, Meat and Jim were sent packing to look elsewhere, with Todd Rundgren willing to foot the bill for the recordings in the end, as he finally saw its potential. However, they just needed a deal to get the album out there and to promote it. That's when Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band member, Steven Van Zandt, and Meatloaf's manager, David Sonnenberg, made the label Cleveland International Records aware of Meatloaf and Jim Steinman, after being impressed with the spoken word intro to You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth. Despite Meatloaf's outburst and protest about the band name omitting Jim Steinman's name, it wouldn't result in much change anyway, as they finally agreed to sign a deal with CBS under the name Meatloaf with songs by Jim Steinman. However, it wouldn't be under Clive Davis directly, and instead was under the subsidiary label of Epic Records and CBS, called Cleveland International Records. However, even when they finally got signed to Cleveland and Epic Records, they continued to receive pushback about the Bat Out of Hell album, with Meatloaf's former tour manager, Sam Ellis, stating to Behind the Music, quote, "There was a guy who later became head of promotion for Epic Records. He took the record in Connecticut and he threw it in the ocean. And he said, 'This will never sell. It's too theatrical. I don't understand it. I don't get this big fat guy and this rock and roll music that sounds like it should be in a theater." But despite the haters, the package deal would continue on, as they began gigging in small clubs and bars across the USA. Most people would find their act confusing, as Meat said, quote, "I was probably around 320 pounds, I wore a tuxedo and stood on stage with a red scarf, and Jimmy's over here in black leather, wearing black gloves, trying to play piano. It had to be a fairly, I don't know, if incredible is the word, but it had to be weird." Meatloaf would also perform with a red bandana, scarf or handkerchief on stage to wipe away the sweat which eventually became part of his gimmick. And when he became popular, he claims Pavarotti started doing the same thing, wearing a white scarf. Despite these initial thoughts about the duo, Meatloaf's audience began to grow as the pair began to gel. Jim Steinman claimed that he always felt it was amazing that two people from such different backgrounds could understand and complement each other so well, claiming, quote, "It's amazing on an intuitive level. I mean, the fact that he just understands these songs. We have such different backgrounds. He and I, such different lifestyles. We're totally different people completely. And yet he understands these things totally. And I think I understand him totally as a performer." During early 1976, Meatloaf took a short break from the Bat Out of Hell project as he worked on a track called Keeper Keep Us for a Sci-Fi Project album, self-titled by Intergalactic Tour Band, who were actually a fictitious band with fake names but real performers. However, it failed to make much of an impact. Meat would then collaborate with Ted Nugent for his album Free For All, heading into the studio at the Sound Pit in Atlanta, Georgia, in the US. Meatloaf was invited to sing on the album by producer Tom Werman and was paid just $1,000 to sing on 5 of the 9 tracks from the original version of the album, with Meat being handed the lyrics and left to arrange his own vocals himself without actually hearing the instrumentals over just 2 recording sessions. Meatloaf would feature on the songs Writing on the Wall, Street Rats, Together, Hammer Down, and I Love You, So I Told You a Lie. The album was later released during September 1976 and managed to chart at number 14 in Sweden, 24 in the US, 31 in Canada, 33 in the UK, and 84 in Australia. While it also became Ted Nugent's first album to go platinum, and in fact made it to double platinum in the US, selling around 2 million copies there. Ted Nugent remained good friends with Meatloaf after this, and spoke about the time he shared with him on stage during an interview with Classic Rock, as he said, quote, "I had first performed with Meatloaf in 1967, when Stoney and Meatloaf opened for the Amboy Dukes around Michigan and the Midwest. I knew his incredible voice would be perfect to deliver my new songs, so I called him. He thundered in and did an amazing job. His work ethic, dedication to ultimate excellence, and wonderful sense of humour was thoroughly appreciated and enjoyed by my whole team." With the Ted Nugent collaboration behind him, Meatloaf would turn his attention back to the Bat Out of Hell album, which was set for release in October the following month. What Meatloaf didn't realise, however, is just how big he was about to be on the world stage. Thank you for tuning into that episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes, ranging from Kurt Cobain and Freddie Mercury to Prince, Tracy Chapman and Stevie Nicks, and up-and-comers like Youngblood, Tones and I, and The Kid Laroi. For more information regarding this episode, including weekly updates and more, head to our Facebook page at Lyrics of Their Life Podcast or our website at lyricsoftheirlife.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and even YouTube and Spotify, where you can find a range of playlists featuring the music of every artist covered in the Lyrics of Their Life podcast so far. If you really enjoy the podcast and would like to give back for the hard work that goes into it, it would be greatly appreciated if you could leave a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, or you can now rate the podcast on Spotify. Don't forget to let your friends and family know about what they've been missing out on, and feel free to click the free subscribe or follow button to the podcast wherever you listen, so you can receive a notification every time a new episode becomes available. If you would like to support the podcast financially, then please feel free to head to Patreon or buymeacoffee.com, where you can contribute your support for the podcast in exchange for some bonus content, ranging from as little as $1 donations to really anything you like. Every bit of support is greatly appreciated, and it means I can continue to bring you more great episodes in the future. This podcast is created and researched completely independently, so your contribution would really help this podcast continue on. Once again, thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed that episode. I'm your host, Adam Hampton, and this is Lyrics of Their Life.